Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. I'm listening for the feedback. Okay. James McCanny here with my Science Hour going into the show tonight, July 26, 2012. And first of all, I apologize for the bad feed of last week. We had some technical problems. But last week was absolutely a must-listen show. So if you did not hear the show last week, either on the internet or live, the archive is available, as always, on my webpage, jmccsci.com. And the show, I covered a lot of Planet X issues. And anyway, just go and listen. Understand that it was a must-listen show, and the archive is on my webpage, the archive, the weekly radio show archive subpage. So make sure you listen to last week's show. And I apologize for the technical difficulty. Okay, let's see. I had a concept. There are states that are thinking about or trying to opt out, and Arizona, Vermont, other states have talked about leaving the union. I have a better idea. I think we should take the state, the eastern part, or just the eastern seaboard of New York, down to Washington, D.C. I think we should take the part of the area of Southern California, part of the area of Southern Florida, and make those independent. I wouldn't call them independent countries, but here's the problem. The rest of the country is producing, and the vast majority of these areas are not producing. In other words, they live off the excess, or now there's very little excess. But I would say for sure New York City down to D.C. and make that a completely independent area. They would soon learn that they are living off the fat of the land. And really, if you take the banks, the insurance companies, the medical industry, the pharma industry, and basically take the profit out of those, this country would be able to finally turn the corner and come back. But at any rate, I'm going to be talking a little bit more. Last week, a lot of people responded positively regarding my analysis of interest. And I showed how at a 30% interest, simple interest, 30% interest, the person borrowing the money does much better, and the institution that would be loaning at simple interest can double or even triple investors' money in a year, something that is unheard of in the financial world. So at any rate, I gave a simple example and then compared it to compound interest. So the bottom line is that compound interest is killing everybody in the world. Compound interest cannot work. It was outlawed in all of the Old Testaments, in the old texts. Compound interest simply has to be banned. And there again, it's the New York bankers that are related to the European banking community. And I had some listeners write in, and of course, that's something I happen to know a little bit about myself. But somebody wrote in, and I've mentioned a number of times that compound interest and anything but the lowest form of simple interest was outlawed in all of the old texts. So a listener wrote in, he said, you know, he was wondering where compound interest was introduced. How did that get into our financial system? And so at any rate, the listener looked it up, and here's what happened. During the Middle Ages, the kings needed money for warfare. And up to that time, compound interest was strictly forbidden. So the kings allowed compound interest because they wanted to borrow from the Jewish lenders of Europe, and that would allow them to fund their wars. Well, how were the kings going to pay back a loan, especially with compound interest, if they did not have any money in the first place? If they were going to fund their own war, they would just fund it themselves. Why go out and borrow money? So that's when the burden of paying this back went on to the citizenry. Excuse me. I'm just having a problem with a frog in my throat this week. Okay, so the bankers then held it over the kings. And now, I heard a very interesting discussion of money and how money and loans to government works. And the question arose, how could a country as powerful as, say, the United States or Russia become indebted to bankers? And the bankers are just people with suits on. How could they have power over the governments? Well, that's a long history, too. It goes back to the Middle Ages, where the governments were, in fact, part of the banking system. That's where the Windsors, a part of the Rothschild family of Europe, come from. They are not of the heritage of England. They married into that with convenient marriages through the Middle Ages. Okay, so now we have the link between governments, especially royalty-type governments, and then let's look at what happened in the New World when Columbus discovered the Caribbean. Then all of a sudden there was a tremendous amount of activity and resource grabbing. So governments became involved in resource grabbing. And, of course, the big push at that time was to take all of the wealth, the gold, the silver, the metals, the timber, all of the resources of Latin America, what we now call Latin America, and bring them back and lay them in the laps of the kings. And, of course, the English and the Spanish, the Portuguese started out. There were other companies that looked. You had the Dutch East Indies companies, which was out of Holland and which was responsible for the slave trade in much of the New World, bringing the black slaves from Africa in boats under horrendously horrible conditions into the United States and into the Caribbean and into Latin America, what we now call South America, bringing them and making a profit off this human misery. And so, anyway, the point is that now you see how compound interest got hooked into the banking system and how then it got involved in warfare. So how could the bankers control a powerful country? Well, by funding all of the countries, especially foes, they could keep all of the basically a balance of power amongst the people in the governments of the world. And this balance of power, what we learned about in grade school, was something beneficial. A balance of power was good because no country could be more powerful and dominate the other. They couldn't dominate us, we couldn't dominate them. But the real situation behind the balance of power was that the banks were funding both sides. And those leaders knew it. And they realized that if they stepped out of line and didn't pay the bankers back, the bankers would fund the other side, that other side would conquer them, and they would be history. So this is how the banks control governments, all the governments of the world. And how do the banks understand? How come the countries can't have information and really get rid of this banking interest? Well, it's because the governments are really controlled at a high level by people that they put there. And, for example, in the United States, a very important information gathering agency is in charge of this. They are the police force of the World Bank in the United States. They're called the CIA. So you will find a revolving door, for example, between the CIA, other alphabet security agencies of the United States, and the banking industry. So how does that? That's a very convenient business cycle. And what happens? The people of the United States, then, the taxation, is linked to warfare. That's why you have to have constant warfare, constant conflict. And whenever there's a president being elected, the first thing they always say is he has to be tough on defense. He has to be big on defense, because there's a whole series of industries that revolve around defense. They are the richest people in the country. Many times you don't know who their names are. You don't know who they are. They're just very wealthy, like the guy that was driving the submarine. Remember when it basically came nose first out of the water, crashed into a Japanese fishing boat, and the guy was doing that. The guy that was driving the submarine was doing it as a joyride. And how do you get to joyride and drive a submarine? Well, you got to be pretty high up in the the military industrial complex of one of the big heavy hitters. So at any rate, that's somewhat of a history of money. And I just want to read a little passage here. This is my Banking 101 lesson of the week. The following comes from a book called Rulers of Evil by F. Tupper Saucy. It's a book that was sent to me by a guy named Pastor Peter Peters quite a while ago. I was on his show one time talking about how prime numbers are used to schedule dates of events that would change world politics or world the situations in the world, like 9/11, for example, 9/11, and other dates associated with other major movements that give control. And so anyway, Pastor Peters, bless his soul, now deceased, of course, sent me this book by F. Tupper Saucy, and on page 160, I want to read, and this is after they're talking about the King George of England. It said, Frederick of Hesse was one of Europe's richest rulers. Much of his business was handled by his son, Prince William, also a Rosicrucian Freemason. William's specialty was facilitating war. He drafted able-bodied mailed Hessians, outfitted and trained them for battle, and then sold them to the English cousin George, who used them to fight alongside his own redcoats. Every time a Hessian was killed, William received a reparation in the form of extra compensation. As the casualties mounted, so did his profits, and he loaned that out at interest. In September 1769... You might notice that that's just before the Revolutionary War in the United States, that date. It says, in September 1769, Prince William appointed Mayor Amschel Rothschild of nearby Frankfurt to transact some of his financial affairs in the capacity of Crown agent. Aware that the Rothschilds were an important Jewish family, looked up the symbol of the Rothschilds, and that they bear the title Guardians of the Vatican Treasury. The Vatican Treasury, of course, holds the imperial wealth of Rome. Imperial wealth grows in proportion to its victories in war. As the Jesuit empowerment, the church at war is more necessary than the church at peace. According to H. Russell Robinson, Illustrated Armor of Imperial Rome, Caesarian soldiers protected themselves in battle with shields painted red. Since the soldiery is the state's most valuable resource, the Council of Trent admitted this in preferring the Jesuits to all other religious orders. It is easy to understand why the red shield is identified with the very life of the church. Hence the appropriateness of the name Rothschild. Name, it's the German translation, is Red Shield. The appointment of the Rothschilds gave the Black Papacy absolute financial privacy and secrecy. Ever search a family of Orthodox Jews for the key, holding the key to the Roman Catholic Church. Anyway, I want to stop there, but when you look at what's going on in the world today and you understand who is running the show above the Obamas and the Romneys and all of the other people, you have to understand that the Dutch West Indies Company that provided the slave trade, that eventually moved into New York and started the New York Stock Exchange, that converted Wall Street, which was a prison wall meant to keep those traders out of New York, finally broke down, and Wall Street today is the trading capital of the world. If you look at the way Wall Street has turned now, it's not based on gain or improvement. For example, if there's a tremendous downturn in the economy, people on Wall Street still make a lot of money. How can you get money out of an economy that is crashing? Well, it's called short selling. They change and they make all the rules so that you out there pay and they make money no matter what happens. It's a very convenient little business. But most of all, they make money off of warfare, guaranteeing that there are wars in the world, stress, and controlling the governments to make sure that the governments are always at odds with each other. And all you need in each country is a few hundred thousand young men desperate for work, not knowing what the country is all about, and willing to join the military. You got yourself an army, and all you got to do then is convince the rest of the people that this is for the nationalism, and that boogeyman over there, we got to keep fighting and developing new technologies. I got my own view into this back in the early 1980s when I was out in L.A. looking for venture capital for some of my early scientific ventures. And I realized that the technologies that were developed here were immediately available in Russia. And I thought, well, this should be top secret. How can these top secret technologies and engineering discoveries be moved into Russia so quickly? What I later found out is that the families that are involved in making international warfare and making a great profit at it wanted to make sure that no country had technology better than the other one. So it was an absolute race when a young engineer with a good idea improving an aircraft or some type of military technology came in and thought that this would be kept secret. Little did he know that in days there was a race by the top military arms salesman in the world. There was an absolute race to get it to Russia because the first guy that got it there was the guy that got to sell it, and the second guy didn't get a dime. So at any rate, this guaranteed a balance of power, guaranteed warfare, and I remember my dad telling me when I was a kid that they had fought World War II, the war to end all wars. Well, I guess that wasn't quite exactly the way it was, but they were able to fool that generation into thinking that, and they're still doing it today. Okay, so now I just want to mention briefly the staged shooting last Thursday evening. As my show was taking place last Thursday, there was a shooting going on in Colorado, and now 1 week later we find out that this guy probably didn't even do it. He was set up, or if he did, he was completely drugged. There were other people involved. How did somebody like this get a hold of all of these armaments, etc.? So obviously, and then of course last Monday was the impending vote for the control of arms away from the citizenry. I'll have a couple more comments on that a little bit later. But just want to comment here. A friend of mine, switching gears a little bit, A friend of mine's name, his name is James Jancic. He's a talk show host from Chicago. I'd been a talk guest on his show many times. Dozens, maybe hundreds of times, I don't even know, over many years. And he called me up a couple weeks ago and he said that I'm going to have my last show on July 20th. So I was a guest on his show last Friday. His show name was Feet to Fire. So at any rate, just wanted to give a salute to James Jancic. I told him, I said, it's getting very thin out here as far as talk show hosts are concerned. Another friend of mine, John Moore, is still on the air, still going well, I hope. But the number of people out here, when I started a dozen years ago or so with my own show, and of course I had been guest on many radio shows before that, including Coast to Coast, Art Bell, you know, lots and lots of shows, and over those years, probably I had been guest with just about every radio show in existence. And all I can say is that the vast majority of the talk show hosts that I was guest, they are gone. They are gone. Probably at least 50 that I can think of, talk show hosts around the U.S., Canada, England, etc., have gone by the wayside, mostly for financial reasons. But people who were seeking the truth, trying to get information to you, and as I told James this past week, it's getting very thin out here as far as trying to keep information going. Something that I do as my own personal interest in this show, because I know a lot of people listen and a lot of people benefit by the information I'm putting out. And so I plan to be here as long as I am breathing, as far as I can tell now. So at any rate, James, best wishes. And by the way, James does plan to return in the near future. So if he does, I'll make an announcement and let you know. Also keep an eye peeled for his show to come back. I hope he does. Just a quick hurricane season update. There ain't any. That's the hurricane season update. I gave a prediction at the beginning of the year, and I said there's nothing going on this year regarding hurricanes, and so far I'm right. We can always hit August, the peak of the hurricane season, and there can always be some activity then. We've had some significant solar flaring. We had a big explosion come out of the sun just minutes ago before I came on the air tonight. But it went in the other direction, nothing that was earthbound. But as far as severe weather, the earth is fairly tranquil unless you're living on the southeast coast of India. And I imagine I have a few listeners there. They might be in a small building someplace on the coast of southeastern India and listening to this show, but it's they're having some very severe weather there. The rest of the world is pretty tranquil, weather-wise. There was somebody sent me this, and I think you should look this up. It's called Athens, Tennessee, the Battle for Athens, I think it was called, the video. But just look up Athens, Tennessee, and you will find references to this. I believe it was on YouTube. And it was a reenactment of an event that took place in 1946. I believe it was in July of 1946 in Athens, Tennessee, when the soldiers had come back from World War II. The county, the local government had been taken over by a group of people who bullied their way, the police. There was a lot of corruption there. And so one of the GIs ran for office. And so they were waiting for the results, and he promised for honesty and reform in the government. And as the ballot box came, the voting came to the end of the day, the police, who were controlled by the local politicians, who had, by the way, had gotten all the way up to the state level at that point, came in, seized the ballot box, and were going to go off for the official count. What does that sound like? It just sounds like stuff that goes on today. So anyway, the boys that just came back from war went down to the local armory, pulled out the guns, and went over to have a little conversation with the corrupt local police and politicians who were going to rig the vote. So at any rate, they had a shootout. And this is very interesting to watch. There was a shootout, and they got the ballot boxes, and they counted the votes, and the GI that was running won the election and was able to reform the government and get things back on track there. This sounds a lot like what we're dealing with today, but the reason I'm mentioning this is because today we don't have a local military like this or local people. They can't get over to the local armory to get weapons because there aren't any. Those were taken out by Clinton back during the Clinton watch. He took the all of the food and arms out of the local armories. In other words, he dismantled the local ability to take care of themselves so that the federal government was in charge. And also, I just want to make a point that it is not like today. The citizenry is on their own. Of course, this staged shooting in Colorado was nothing less than a government push to try and get legislation passed to take arms away from people. And I like this. I got an email from somebody that this is from Australia, and the law enforcement in Australia. I want to read this just because I think this is so well written, and it talks about what happened in Port Arthur, Australia. It says, "Dear all, what you had at Colorado was a rerun of the Port Arthur massacre on the 28th of April 1996. The intended target at Port Arthur were two coachloads of American senior citizens and a ski holiday. But things went wrong and the target moved to what had been considered a safe house, and Australia lost seven intelligence operatives. When the supposed lone nut gunman was in court being sentenced on the 19th, 20th, and 22nd of November 1996, where was U.S. President Bill Clinton? On the 21st of November 1996, President Bill Clinton addressed the Australian Federal Parliament in Canberra. Bill also congratulated the Australian Prime Minister, Little Johnny Howard, on his gun control efforts. So why is the gun control agenda taking place in America right as this particular moment? Because Hillary knows that she will not be back in office next year. Expect another massacre shortly." So at any rate, you're seeing the response from that, in that case, Australia, and from around the world. The rest of the world is watching this, and that pretty much speaks for itself. Just one last comment on the currently what's going on. You are going to see your insurance rates going through the ceiling. And what's going on, I call it the last grab. Businesses are grabbing for everything they can get at this point. And that's not the least of which is the insurance industry. So watch for rates to go up, payouts to go away, and of course, much of this is required by law. Insurance, especially auto insurance, is the big one where you're going to find the rates increasing, etc. And I just want to make one comment on the immigration issue. This has many sides and many aspects to it, but what's the one major reason why young immigrants really have to be taken aside and kind of slapped up by the ear? Because I see this is from a newspaper for young immigrants in the U.S., and they're all sitting here listening to Obama's speech, the DREAM Act, and how it might benefit them. What none of them realize, what none of them ever talk about, is what does the United States mean? They don't have any idea, and that's why they're fair game. That's why they like these people here. And I'm not talking against anybody being in the United States. A lot of them have lived here for many years, and their lives are being controlled by political forces far beyond their ability to do anything. And that's really wrong. It's wrong to hold people over these border issues, boundary issues. And likewise, there's a lot of young Americans who would like to go to foreign countries and live there for a while. Not necessarily forever, but to visit. And that is good. But when you come to the United States, the first thing you better learn is that this is not just a place for a better job or higher pay or to take your, or to bring all of your family members here. That's all wonderful. But what it means is you have to defend the rights of the Constitution of this country against the, especially in this case, the government. The government that's trying to erode the rights. And so these young immigrants don't understand. They've never been taught. The United States to them is a nice job and a place to get a better education and a better life. But along with that comes something else. It's called responsibility. It's called understanding what the United States is all about. Excuse me for that diversion. The main science topic this week, I'm going to be talking about the rift areas in around the solar system. What's a rift? A rift is basically a split in the Earth's surface or in the surface of Mars. There's one in Africa, the Great Rift. It runs down the southeastern section of Africa. And now one has been discovered, at least claimed to be discovered, under the Antarctic ice cap. And so at any rate, how are these formed? What's going on? Well, the Earth, the standard explanation is that the Earth has plates and they're pulling apart. Well, it doesn't really work. It doesn't work because these rift areas, even though they're very large, the one in Africa runs for about 6,000 kilometers, about 3,500 miles long, much bigger than the Grand Canyon. There's one in Mexico. And so what exactly forms these? Well, clearly the idea that plate tectonics forms these, it simply doesn't cut it. It also doesn't cut it to say that these happened over long periods of time. Something happened very quickly. Something happened dramatic in a few minutes, and I spent a lot of time this past spring around the Grand Canyon area in the southern Utah area, the Bryce Canyon. I talked about that in my show, the Zion National Park, all of the mountains there, which of course are much older, much more weathered. When you look at Bryce Canyon, it's a vast, vast area in which the Earth simply dropped down. It simply dropped into a hole, an underground cavern, obviously. But that's not the standard explanation. The standard explanation is that over millions of years, there was some upward movement. And when you look across this, say, from outer space, when you look at these regions, to imagine that something all of a sudden worked, the plates were working there. Clearly, these have beginnings and ends. For example, the eastern rift zone of the Grand Canyon simply comes up and there's a canyon. It comes almost to a point, almost sharp enough to sharpen a knife. That's how sharp it is. And so clearly something created these caverns, but it was not plate tectonics. But the point is that the majority of these take place on elevated plateaus. The Colorado Plateau is about a 5,000 foot elevated plateau. A lot of people call it the high desert. There are many, the high plains, for example, and that's where a lot of the rift areas are in the United States. If you look at Africa, once again, now when I was talking about the rift zone or the Bryce Canyon rift zone, I talked about how clearly you can go there and you see that along the edges and into the distance away from the canyon, the ground is just, it just comes up to the edge and the ground in the canyon simply dropped in as much as 9,000 feet. So obviously what had to have happened was there had to be large chambers underground. Something had to shake these, and then the layers started falling in, of course, deeper in the center part. And as you work your way up towards the edge, you can literally see, you come in a couple hundred yards and there's a big chunk that has dropped down maybe 200-300 yards. Then you come in a little farther. Maybe the next chunk has dropped down 1,000 feet, about 300-400 yards. And this continues as you go out into the canyon. These canyons simply dropped straight down. What kind of earth activity would cause this type of rift zone? How could something simply drop down into the earth? And I'm not talking about hollow earth from gravitational, our understanding of gravity, etc. The earth is a very compact, solid region. But when major volcanic formative processes are underway, then that gives way to large chambers, large tunnels underground. And when the earth was younger, these tunnels tended to be very large. You can see lava tubes in any volcanic region of the world. If you can, you can see pictures of these on the internet. If you don't have the ability to go look at, but go to any volcanically active area on Earth, and you're going to see lava tubes. But imagine when the Earth was young and formative, and the bubbles were coming up, and like hot gases forming bubbles, and then started to solidify. You could get regions, vast regions that had canals, channels, tunnels, tubes, as they are called. And then when a large object came by afterwards, all of a sudden there was enough to shake these regions and they dropped down in to those caverns. Now, the point of this is, if you look on Mars, Mars has Grand Canyon areas also. The formation of these kind of rift areas is dependent on, and it has to be coordinated with, the passage of large celestial objects. When they talk about the rift zone that was just discovered in Antarctica, there's a video, I just received this, I was watching it a bit before the show. They go through a whole series of explanations that hundreds of millions of years ago, and then they talk about the ice forming, and you know, it's a lot of hand waving. Standard science, especially in geology, when you're talking about formative processes, when they go back hundreds of millions of years, this is a lot of hand waving because they're talking about the Earth being exactly the same. You have to understand that Earth has gone through pole shifts. How can the Earth go through pole shifts? Well, in standard science, there's a plethora of explanations of people that try to explain pole shifts. For example, it snowed more on this side of the Earth, so it developed a wobble, and that caused a pole shift. Well, those type of effects, first of all, would be minuscule, and second of all, don't explain a overall pole shift of, say, 30 degrees, like we know happened only a number of thousand years ago within the last 10,000 years. So the point is that standard science has to explain these events, and typically they depend on hand-waving over long periods of time. Who's going to say that they didn't happen over a long period of time if there is no proof? They have no proof of anything they're talking about. If you talk, if you look at the ancient texts, it's very clear they talk about mountain building. They talk about the oceans moving across the land. They talk about tidal waves. They talk about and they also talk about what caused these. They were the ancient comets, the big comets that came through the solar system. Did they crash into Earth? No. Was there more than one? Yes. Was there a periodicity to these events? There's really no way of saying this. There's no detailed data in the ancient texts to talk about whether there's a periodicity. There's a lot of chatter on the internet today about Planet X 3,600-year orbit, and so I want to address that also. This is a good time to talk about that. Let's play devil's advocate, and let's say that there was such an object, and it had a 3,600-year orbit. Well, we already have a history going back 3,600 years. A large comet came through the solar system somewhere in that time frame and became the planet Venus. So there's a lot of people that confuse the Venus event, and it was a Planet X type of event. It was just one of the Planet X type of events. But if Venus, the comet, the proto-planet comet, became the planet Venus, then it's not out there to come back in and do damage again. It's already nestled into the orbit where we see Venus today. So there are many out there. There's many more out there, is the point. And so if you go back farther into history, let's play the devil's advocate. Imagine that there is a object called Planet X, Wormwood, whatever. Let's imagine this is a hypothetical imagination that it were on a 3,600-year orbit. Earth moves around in its orbit, which is a fairly sizable orbit. We're 153 million miles from the sun. And so it's and we're very small. And for an object to actually cause severe damage on Earth, especially the kind that we've seen in the past with the comet Venus passing by, which was a very close passage, what's the probability that that object is going to have a close encounter with Earth on every time that it comes back, on every orbit, every 3,600-year orbit? Very little. The chances that it would have an encounter with Earth on even 1 out of 10 orbits is very minute. The chance that it would have an encounter with Earth on every 100 orbits, well, there's some possibility, depending on what its orbit is. Even if it were in the plane of the planets, even if it were in the ecliptic, if its orbit lies out of the ecliptic, like we think is possibly the case where Harrington, I was talking about Harrington and his study with NASA, they thought that the Planet X object they were talking about at the time, and they did call it Planet X, they said it was coming from down in that lower portion of the solar system, out of Sagittarius, I believe. And so, at any rate, if an object is in an orbit like that, it has a much lower probability of encountering any of the planets than if it were on an orbit in the plane of the planets. Okay, so what is the probability? This is the simple question. Let's play devil's advocate. Let's pretend, let's say that there is an object, that there could be an object. Let's say it that way. There could be an object in a 3,600-year orbit, that it's big. What's the probability of it having an encounter with Earth every time it comes back? The probability is fairly low. So to get the number of interactions that Earth has had in the past with big major objects, it isn't due to one object. It's not due to a single particular object. And let me tell you a little story about Hale-Bopp. When Hale-Bopp was first discovered, it was on an almost direct collision course with Earth. It caused a great deal of excitement at a place called Goddard Space Flight Center. There was a lot of activity. There was a lot of, interest, severe interest in this thing called Hale-Bopp. And it's very clear that Harrington and probably other people had seen this object and seen other objects coming into the solar system prior to that, probably in the 1980s, probably in the into the 1990s. Remember that the Harrington abstract that I read on last week's show was from March 1989, so even before 1990. They were looking for these objects, and especially in the southern region of the solar system. When Hale-Bopp was discovered by the amateurs, Hale and Bopp, when the orbit was calculated, it was on a direct collision course with Earth. But NASA never announced that. They never said a word. Remember that they denied that there was a companion to Hale-Bopp. And they blamed the suicide of Heaven's Gate on the Art Bell show with Courtney Brown and Chuck Schrammick. They blamed them and then NASA falsified photos, putting them up for public display, saying that, look, there is no companion. And that was very strange because at the Canary Island Hale-Bopp conference, headed by NASA, the very first topic on the agenda was the companion of Hale-Bopp. And by the way, I've mentioned this before in my show, whatever happened to that companion? Well, it orbited Hale-Bopp and orbited and orbited, and finally the orbit disintegrated because of moving through the dust in the tail material of Hale-Bopp. Eventually that companion nestled down and became part of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. So at any rate, Hale-Bopp had a direct collision course with Earth, but NASA never told anybody. And if you were a NASA scientist, you would have believed that that orbit would have held constant, because at the time they only believed that the small comets would have significant orbital changes due to a concept they called jetting. They said that dirty snowballs, when the jets came off the nucleus, it had the potential to push the nucleus out of its orbit, and therefore it would cause a perturbation in the orbit, a change in the orbit. But Hale-Bopp had a very big nucleus. So according to NASA and Brian Marsden and all the other comet guys out there, the orbit of Hale-Bopp should not have changed, but it changed on a daily basis. By the time Hale-Bopp got anywhere near the orbit of Earth, Hale-Bopp had slowed down considerably, and we moved about 90 degrees farther in our orbit, and Hale-Bopp missed us by a tremendous amount. But remember, Hale-Bopp was on a direct collision course with Earth. And that's one of the biggest weather, and I really get a kick out of all the apologists for NASA. They try and say that, oh, that orbit was perturbed by Jupiter. No, that would not have caused it to slow down in its orbit by that much. That could have changed its direction, but the original orbit of Hale-Bopp was on a direct collision course with Earth. Interacting with Jupiter would not have slowed its orbit down, its path and its orbit. And so the fact that Earth had moved 90 degrees farther, in fact a quarter of a year, farther, about 90 days farther, about 3 months farther in its orbit, when Hale-Bopp finally crossed the ecliptic plane, Earth was a full 100 days past where Hale-Bopp came through. And so, but let's look at what NASA did, or better yet, let's look at what NASA didn't do. They did not announce that. They did not announce that there was a huge comet with a direct collision course with Earth. That was in around 1995 when Hale-Bopp was discovered. NASA did not announce that. And so now that's proof, that's 110% proof that if there were ever a big dangerous object in this solar system that endangered Earth, it proves 100%, 110% that NASA would never tell you. That's proof in the pudding, as they say. Okay, so back to, I started this conversation by talking about rift zones on Earth and talking about the frequency with which large objects in the solar system come near Earth and cause major damage. Then remember I talked about a specific hypothetical object that would be on a 3,600-year orbit. I wish I had better data to present on this particular topic. There are people right now making a statement that a Planet X object should be here within weeks of this when we were talking. But remember, I went on the internet and I looked up the number of people that are claiming at this time to have discovered Nibiru and are saying that it's imminently on approach to Earth. Over a million websites. If anybody had any real information, how would it ever surface in this sea of misinformation? That's the one question I've talked recently to people about that particular issue. How would a particular statement, if somebody had real information, how would they get above the noise level that's on the internet with real information, because it's drowned out by such a large amount of misinformation? So at any rate, the point of this is that we see the scars on Earth, whether they were made by electrical discharges, whether they were made by splitting of those elevated plateaus, just the simple splitting where the Earth has to pull apart. Now, you have to understand something also. And I've talked before about the mountain building that takes place as the large tidal waves from a large passing celestial object, the tidal waves in the land that ultimately reach a mountain range, the wave of energy is absorbed in the mountain, and then that is the source of mountain building, radical change in the mountain structures. That's why mountain building continues at the location where mountains have already started, because those waves hit that barrier and that energy is absorbed there, causing more mountain building in that area. That's why, for example, you'll see in, for example, the southern Colorado Rockies, you see volcanic type of activity mixed in with upthrust mountain type of building, mountain building activity. So you see these mixed together because that energy is concentrated in those locations. But the fact that mountain building occurs, energy and land mass has to go into building the mountains, wouldn't it be logical that somewhere out there in the plains near the mountain building or in that region, you would also have to have rift zones. You would have to have places where the Earth is split apart. It's like a conservation of matter type of situation. If you have land going into the mountain building, that's going to leave a gap behind someplace. Something has to give. So at any rate, the rifts in the Earth, in Mars, and if you look at Antarctica, once again, these have to occur in places where there are plate boundaries. The plates are... what I'm saying is that they are not caused by splitting of plates, as in plate boundaries. They are caused by basically the land has to, something has to give, something has to pull apart as the energy waves move into making the mountains. And you can see the earth adjusting, the structures below adjusting as this tremendous shaking is going on. Once someone asked me what the level of earthquakes would be in a massive earth transition like this with a large passing celestial object. And we're used to, on the Richter scale, an 8 is very large, a 9 would be extremely large, a 10 would shake any city in the world and to its knees, even if that city had been properly built for earthquake. Most construction limits don't go up past a 9 on a Richter scale, but I was talking about a 20 to 25 on the Richter scale. As a friend of mine always says, the biblical prophecies talking about all walls falling. I just want to remind you, I have a new product out there. It's doing very well, and I'm very thankful that people are recognizing the value in this. It is called the Emergency Survival Recalendar Portable Sunstar Clock, and it allows you to rebuild the calendar, whether there's a man-made emergency or disaster, or whether we have a complete pole shift. It allows you to rebuild the calendar and have a sun clock so you know what the date is. You can very quickly build a calendar, understand what the date is, and this is something that anybody can use. So make sure you visit my webpage, jmccsci.com, and check it out. If you buy two of them, you get free shipping. But it's a very simple device. It's something anybody can use. The instructions come with it. And I don't think I would leave home without it. I'd probably leave my American Express card or Capital One. Which one is the one you're not supposed to leave home without? I would think I'd leave that and take my calendar star clock, recalendar star clock device with me instead. Probably be a lot more valuable in the majority of situations. The concept for that came a long time ago. And as I said,